When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All right, we are ready, Jeremy. Vince, why don't you go on ahead and start us off with the first question, or I could ask the first question.
Go ahead.
Okay, Jeremy, I just watched Rebel Ridge. Why do you insist on making your movies so kick-ass? Have you ever thought about making a stinker?
Oh, all the time. My entire career, I'm trying to build up enough cred so I can make a stinker and have to, you know, have enough as far as my filmography and the weight that I can pull as far as getting out of director's jail. I'm always planning for that because, you know, one day, I mean, some would argue from an audience point of view that Hold the Dark was a stinker, but I like that film. But no director's jail yet. So, but I'm ready. I will dig myself the fuck out of director's jail. I can get a camera, call up Macon Blair, go into the woods, come back with the movie.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. How many more flicks do you think we are away from you making your own personal Heaven's Gate?
Actually, I feel pretty good about the current trajectory. So I'm gonna say I'll make, well, it depends on how much money if I get an ungodly amount of money to make a stinker, I will, and I will secure the future of my family, and then I will just sort of, you know, be unbridled. I will make whatever the fuck I want. But in the meantime, just trying to keep it tight.
Keep it tight. All right, Vince, you can ask a real question.
Well, welcome back. I think the last time we had you on the Frogcast was like 2016 or something like that, right around. Maybe it's 2015 around Green Room.
Been a while.
So these days when you're writing, do you have a setting in mind, or do you try to have, do you have to like write it based on whichever location is giving like the biggest tax incentives?
Both. For Rebel Ridge in particular, you know, the research indicated, yeah, any sort of southern town in sort of the deep red states would work. But also upstate New York. I mean, this sort of shit happens everywhere. And, you know, the central premise being, you know, civil asset forfeiture, even if your local PD or state legislature outlaws it, you can bypass all state regulations and join up with the federal government and do the same shit and split the proceeds. So it could take place anywhere. I wanted to do it in the South just because I'm attracted, you know, I'm a Virginia boy. Grew up, you know, closer to D.C., but I love that part of the country. And boiled down to, you know, pick Georgia or Louisiana. Because of my proximity growing up to Georgia, it felt familiar. And Louisiana was a little more exotic to me. I'd never really been. And it has so much sort of diversity in terrain and, you know, the swamps and these sort of bucolic fields and very attractive visually. So landed there.
Right. So you guys grew up in Alexandria. Is that like, do you think of that more southern in character or more like DC suburb, or is there like
it's certainly sort of DC suburb, but you can travel 45 minutes and be in like real Virginia, as they say, which is great because I can go to a metal show in Manassas and feel that like full redneck vibes. And that's where Green Room came from. It's like being alone at metal shows and feeling quite vulnerable. But where I lived was just like really cool suburbs of DC. So 5 minute drive to downtown. And my friends and I utilized the 14th Street Bridge all the time to go see shows at 9:30 or Black Cat or whatnot. So it was a very diverse spot to grow up in. And it's a little more, even though geographically it's more southern than Baltimore, you know, it's really not as far as culturally.
Yeah, I remember when I was like visiting friends that lived in the DC area, and we'd go to I don't know, like Arlington or something, and it would be all of a sudden you're like, oh, I can, this is like 2008 or 2009, and it was like, oh, you can like smoke in bars here. There's still like cigarettes and vending machines. I don't know if it still has that, like, oh, like there's like a border town feel to it a little bit, where it's like, oh, the rules on this side of the river are a little more relaxed.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've done that sort of thing. I haven't gone to shows in a while, but yeah, it was cool. You can, like, I had cousins in Reston, Virginia, which is very different. So you get in a car and drive an hour, you can be kind of anywhere.
Yeah. How'd you feel about, this is your second one, I think, right? Opening on Netflix. How did you feel about opening on Netflix?
I mean, shit, not until it premiered, you know, day two is when it smacked everybody in the face, and it was way bigger than anyone thought it would be.
Nice.
So this time around, you know, it's been amazing. Honestly, it feels like a huge release.
Yeah.
We did not get theaters, but we got the entire internet talking about it, which is exciting.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I really wish I could have seen this in the theater on the one hand, but then on the other, like, it did seem like it wasn't right the day of opening, but maybe like 4 or 5 days after, it seemed like, oh, this is the movie that everybody's talking about now.
Yeah, I mean, we always want theatrical as filmmakers, but it wasn't in the cards this time around. We had it for Hold the Dark. Mm-hmm. But that felt like such a small release. So again, I try very hard to protect the art itself. I try to make the movie what it can be. And the benefit of Netflix is they allow me as a filmmaker to do bold things with casting that are not allowed outside those walls, as far as I'm concerned, and definitely not in traditional studios, as far as, you know, the aggregate star power you need to get a green light and whoever they deem bankable enough to justify a big ad spend and a big release. Yeah. And that was the genius of this near implosion that was Rebel Ridge. And we got Aaron Pierre to save the day, and the fucking guy overachieves, and we get to watch him become a movie star before our very eyes. And that just wouldn't have happened elsewhere. So very grateful for that end of it all.
I'm interested in the near implosion that you alluded to. In what way was there a near implosion?
Oh, come on, man. You know that.
Yeah, no, I don't know anything.
No, it was just like a long road to get this movie shot. So to get it in the can took 3 consecutive tries. Mm. You know, we were sitting in a dire situation, but held the line at quality and risked everything and risked the whole film being shelved, you know, unless we found the right star to be in this film.
It almost seems kind of like a serendipitous, because I saw that you had John Boyega lined up first, and I think he's a great actor. I think he's awesome, but I'm having trouble now, with the benefit of hindsight, seeing him do kind of the quiet, intimidating menace that the lead you cast ended up doing, and I just thought he was like perfect for that role. I thought he was so good.
Yeah, I mean, and that was the goal. Is like, you know, there had been someone else attached before Boyega. Like, a lot of films go through these journeys, and you have to find compatibility. It's not about, you know, one person and the other chasing an actor or them chasing you. It's about finding like-minded artists that will actually go full in. And this movie required 1,000% commitment as far as putting the protagonist in damn near every scene in the movie. And the physical exertion, the training, you know, it was asking a lot. And so the goal was, you know, however we ended up, you know, it had to be an actor at the helm that would just replace all previous iterations and seemed like the only right and true version of the film. And Aaron Peter was the only guy that I saw at the time that had that. And he was very exciting, new to me as an actor. But within 90 seconds of meeting him over Zoom, I knew that he had to make a very big choice. He had to turn down a lucrative offer for a TV show.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And sit on his hands and wait a full year as we regrouped and shot it. So I, you know, him and I went all in together. I guaranteed him if for whatever reasons, if it's not him, the film doesn't exist. I said, I'm going to shelve it. It's just not, once I saw him and knew that version and could see into the future, I'm like, holy shit, this is the guy. There was no other version, and I was willing to just kind of move on to the next if anything was downgraded from there.
Well, I think like it was it a brings
good
up
choice on his end. I mean, just in terms of the success of the movie, what is the metric for success in within Netflix? Because I know it's kind of like they have that like listing of like top 10 movies that are streaming. Is that the only metric that you get, or do you get like numbers of like how many people have watched it?
Oh yeah, they publish that now. So we've had like about 70 million views.
Whoa,
which is staggering for me. You know, I've never had that kind of reach. And we had 31 point something million views the first 3 days.
Wow. So,
I just wanted to.
Everyone was expecting that level. The trailer did quite well. It was, you know, a little over promising on the action, but it certainly worked with the marketing, and that caught fire. It was one of their top performing trailers of the entire year.
Nice.
So I thought it was an interesting. What you brought up was pretty interesting in that, like, you had Boyega, you had somebody before him, and then Aaron kind of ended up being, you know, the right guy, and you can't envision it without him anymore. It's an interesting contrast, because I think what we tend to hear about in the media and what tends to get sort of, you know, turned into legend is like the auteur with like the singular vision, uncompromising. And it's cool because I think the reality is like making a movie, it's such a messy process that's such a rarity that can actually happen. And you could probably make a lot of arguments about the business and whether or not they can even happen at all anymore. And so to come at it from a pragmatic angle, to be like, look, these things kind of have to align for it to come out the right way. I think it's interesting to hear from a director, as opposed to kind of the other way of, you know, I've got this vision, my artistic vision will not be compromised.
I'm special because I can speak freely, because my entire track record has been, you know, I'm batting 1,000 as far as finding the right actors. Now, one doesn't go talk about, you know, this person was my third offer, because that might be misquoted, or, you know, make the actor feel diminished in some way. But to me, you know, I don't know these fucking people. I see talent, and I'm very lucky to be able to, like, honestly, Sophia Robb as Summer in this film. I know she was in some kids movies, and, you know, she's now a good friend of mine, but all I care is when she did her self tape and gave this amazing, warm and raw performance and made my dialogue sing. I was like, whoa, there she is. And, you know, was able to hire her based on sort of a meritocracy approach. And same with the rest of the cast, like for Green Room, you know, Anton was not my first pick. I didn't know him. But of course, you know, and my experience working with him is something I'll take with me, you know, the rest of my life. It was brilliant. He was, of course, the only guy. In Rebel Ridge, you know, I was just trying to get to this point, you know, after the fact and deliver the film and not be full shit when I'm talking about my lead actor. Like, Aaron Pierre really is, to me, the only guy and the best guy in the entire universe to play Terry Richmond. So yeah, it's I think as far as the auteur vision, you know, I certainly, that's a little highfalutin for me, but I want to protect that vision. And the best way to do it isn't to hold strong on like who you thought was right for the role that might not really want to be there. It's who is right for the role, which means someone else to come at you and show their commitment to the material. And with that alchemy, you can hold your vision, you know, as true as you can through any translation from script to screen.
Right. And then like, if you're talking about doing theatrical and then you're in a situation where you're like, okay, we need someone who's like John Cena level for the lead or whatever. It seems like that you end up going down a road where you're making more compromises, like where, cause you know, you get a big star and then they're going to want to have more control over the script, I would imagine. And like, and you're going into like a rewrite process and then the movie is maybe like a different thing. Like, do you feel like you're having more control because you don't have the burden of some of the things that you have to do for theatrical?
Yeah. I mean, that's like, there's some traditional development like that where the actors come first. And of course, financially they should. I mean, they're what bring people to theaters often. The auteurs, you know, can bring a certain limited audience to theaters.
But yeah, the stars, nerds like us.
Yeah, we'll show up.
The star system is hard to track now because it gets obliterated every 2 or 3 years. And you're like, who's worth what now? Huh? Who's this person?
Yeah, did you consider hiring the Hawk Tua girl for this role?
My buddy had a film, you know, and it's like, and you hear from executives, it's like, well, we'll cast so-and-so and a YouTube star. And now it would be a TikTok star. But it's just like, you know, if they were to self-tape and deliver an amazing audition, then yes. But just to, don't say we need a random YouTube star. That's really insulting the art form.
Yeah. It's also like a complete misreading of YouTube stardom. Right. They don't leave the house. Why would they go to a whole theater?
Yeah, have them promote the movie, you know, do some kind of thing.
Yeah.
Cross promotion. But I feel very grateful. And the cast is what makes this movie stand out. I mean, I had my pick, and it's not just the individuals, it's also the alchemy of the mosaic of the different people and the chemistries, and that was able to remain intact throughout the entire process. So that worked out. And I consider, you know, the cast friends, and same with the crew. I mean, we went through a lot, but it was the final iteration, year three of production, 2022. You know, there's a lot of love and a great spirit throughout the shoot. Although
Emery Cohen's one of those guys where like, I see him in this and then I'm like trying to remember where I know him from. And then I'm like looking at him and it was like, I knew him from all these roles that I'd raved about him in, but they didn't immediately come to mind because he's like so different in all of them.
Yeah. He's a chameleon.
He is. And he, you know, I've seen him before. I'm a fan of his work. And yeah, he gave this really creepy fucking audition that made me lean very hard into casting him. And then we had a couple of back and forths and he was the guy, but he, you know, I needed the cast, you know, the police force in the film is a cross section of humanity, but I definitely wanted a psychopath and he gave it to me.
Yeah. And David Denman, I thought, was a terrific choice for the Secret Serpico. You don't see him enough in things, and I've always thought that he had more to give than being Roy from The Office. You know, he's actually he's like a classically trained actor. Like what college did he go to? Isn't it?
Juilliard or something. I don't know.
Yeah, it's like Juilliard or some shit. And it's like, oh, damn. That's crazy.
He's great. I mean, the thing about that character, you know, he needed to do so many things. He needed to be, you know, not able to be read. He has certainly a gravity to him. He's imposing. He can be badass. He can physically, you know, pick you up and smash you and throw you across the room. Mm-hmm. He's also... really, he can be vulnerable. He can be very warm. Pragmatism was a big thing, and especially for Terry Richmond, our man guy, but also for Evan Marston, David's character. And he had to kind of be able to, you know, the audience has to kind of project onto him what they think he is, and he can receive that and reflect it quite well.
Terry Richmond feels like a very 80s basketball name to me for some reason. You think that was a hidden inspiration for you?
You know, yeah. I mean, certainly people in my life, I came across various names and I'm like, ooh, one day I'll use that.
Yeah.
And also Richmond, you know, being from Virginia, it just kind of rolled off.
Sure.
So it's his tribute to Gwar, who's famously from Richmond.
Oh, right.
Odorous, baby. I spent a lot of time in a VCU campus with my buddies in those days. So.
Nice. this is your, I think, second movie. Maybe I'm getting it wrong, but at least your second in which jiu-jitsu features prominently. And I'm sure I asked you this last time around, but like, was that something that came out of you training, or was that just like a thing that you were interested in?
I've been obsessed with fighting. I took some wushu, you know, back in high school, and I loved fighting, not people, but just in general. I was there getting pay-per-view, the very first UFC. So I've been a huge fan of MMA, pride fighting, all that shit since the early 90s. So I know it. I know it very well. Didn't ever really roll. I got some back injuries from, I used to be a B-boy. So I was breaking in New York City, and very similar as far as the muscles you use and the agility, and it's all.
Yeah, very much.
So I wanted to segue to that, but I was feeling my back was feeling pretty good in 2020 when I was shipping off to shoot this the first time before COVID shut us down.
Oh.
My buddy, Gerald Ding, brought me to Gentleman's Fight Club in LA and rolled with me and beat me the fuck up for a little bit. And I got to feel some real jujitsu. He's a very skilled practitioner, and I was very, very kind. But that's all I needed. It was a good thrashing. And I said, I'll stick to writing.
I know a handful of the indie directors that dabble in jujitsu. So, you know, maybe you guys could get in touch.
Yeah, start a league.
If I get surgery, I'm all over it.
Yeah. So tell us about your, so you went from a B-boy to being like a hardcore kid.
So, punk.
Summertime and the living is thirsty. Again, once again, I've done that joke. And once again, it's a great joke.
Very funny, Matt.
Thank you.
But you're right. It is summer. And during the summer, I love to keep Fiji water on hand to keep my family and me hydrated and refreshed.
Here's the thing about Fiji water. It really is from the islands of Fiji.
You're a liar.
No, I swear to God, it actually is. Drop by drop, Fiji water collects in a sustainable, ancient, artesian aquifer 1,600 miles away from the nearest continent, protected and preserved naturally from external elements. But I'm always wondering, Vince, how does Fiji water taste so good?
That's such a good question. And the answer is that as the water filters through volcanic rock, it collects a unique profile of electrolytes and minerals, resulting in more than double the electrolytes as the other two top premium bottled water brands, giving Fiji water its signature soft, smooth taste. You know, yesterday I happened to take my son to California's largest water park, and you know, it's hot out, the sun's beating down, you're carrying a toddler around, you get thirsty.
Sure do.
And you know what I did?
What?
I reached a meaty paw out for that natural artesian spring water that comes only from Fiji.
That's right. That's right. And listen, I enjoy Fiji water on a hot day. I enjoy Fiji water on a cold day. I enjoy Fiji water on a medium day. Just basically whenever I'm thirsty, I reach for a nice bottle of Fiji water.
I know your mouth gets dry when you're trying to do those royalty freestyles sometimes.
It does. It does. I have a very dry mouth. People have commented on that. And I like to wet it with the Fiji water. And here's the thing, Vince. Unlike some other premium bottled water, Fiji water's electrolytes are 100% naturally occurring.
That's like the best kind of electrolytes. And this water even has a perfectly balanced pH of 7.7. Fiji water really is Earth's finest water. And since 2022, its 330 milliliter and 500 milliliter bottles have been produced in 100% recycled plastic, so you can feel proud of your choice in bottled water.
Get stocked up on Fiji water this summer and visit your local retailer to pick some up today for your next backyard party, beach or pool day, hike, or even your home office.
It's not just water, it's Fiji water.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hardcore first. They went to NYU in 94. And to me, you know, it was a very sort of easy transition. It's very physical. There's a cypher. It's a pit in the hardcore scene. It's a cypher in the hip hop scene. But I was very grateful to be in New York. You know, not a whole lesson, but like the exploitation era of b-boying was like the 80s. You know, it's the second gen of b-boys. It got uncool like 87, 88, but the shockwave went across the oceans and hit Europe and Japan and sort of proliferated there, became a big thing in Europe, Japan, and then bounced back. It came back, I call it the Sprite era, in the mid-90s.
Right.
Crazy Legs is getting Sprite gigs, and like Harris One is back solo. And he's so it was a huge time. The rap was great. The DMC battles, and it was like it was fucking great. And you know, we'd go to like see Rocksteady Crew and Cool Herc would be there DJing, and then next we can go to see Murphy's Law and just like throw beer on our punk rock friends. And it was like really formative time in my life, very kinetic.
I have a question. I think obviously Aaron did a great job as the lead. But was there part of you when you're writing it that was like, this is for Macon?
No, this is the first movie that I wrote that wasn't for Macon.
Oh, man. It was, to me, I was like, I could see Macon also doing this. Even not so much the MMA stuff, but everything else, you know, kind of almost like in the same universe as Blue Ruin.
Yeah. There's nothing I like more than to put Macon Blair through the ringer. this is my first time. I'm gonna go like ultra competent. You know, the physicality, you know, I needed this guy. I was originally when I wrote it, it was like someone smaller stature, less imposing, you know, not 6'3", 210, but Aaron had this quality about him. He was just like so thoughtful, so measured, very sort of sharp and quiet. And so I said, oh, he can actually still be a surprise. It's not a surprise that he can like throw someone across the room, but it's still a surprise as far as the character arc is how he reveal who he is and have layers to him. You know, it's not just like some dude.
Right.
Well, there's your next movie is you just remake this movie, but with Macon, and then it goes totally differently every time he has to grapple.
There we go.
I definitely could have seen him in one of like the lawyer or courthouse roles.
Yeah. He had shit to do. He was definitely, you know, we were talking, but that son of a bitch went out and got his own career, and I'm not ever going to live that down. He was actually busy.
What happened to gratitude, man? You know what I mean? What happened to being grateful?
No, he was there. He was behind the scenes the whole time, helping me through this thing.
Oh, that's nice. I love that. Yeah.
So, what was the thought process behind having Terry not be like a traditional goes on like a violent rampage, having your hero be like overtly not into guns and sort of non-killing?
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, I think the marketing, and I went full in with Netflix. I was like, fuck it. Let's get people to click this thing. Let's overpromise the action and make it seem badass. I wish we had that sort of raw festival premiere where no one knew anything about it, because then it would come off like a pressure cooker, but more of the sort of bureaucratic sense, mm-hmm. and stifled by all of these institutions. And he's just kind of, Terry's having a really bad customer service experience.
Right.
Yeah. And as the film evolves and slowly gets more aggro, and this finale would be this huge fucking burst of energy and a certain sort of vengeance. And that's how I think it would play cold. When you come in thinking it's Rambo and you get something different, a few people on the internet are mad, they feel cheated, but that's just the breaks, people. This just came from a place of truth, and I was trying to do that kind of movie. But much like Blue Ruin, even if I did have someone who could be categorized as a traditional male action hero, still do fish out of water, still have him flail and fight his way through these circumstances. But what's truthful? And for Terry in his situation, he is alone in a very small town, outnumbered. He's already had an encounter with the police. He's just tracking like, okay, how do I get out of here? And it's not by taking the police head on and killing them. It's not so much just altruistic, philosophy, as he is a utter pragmatist the entire movie. He has to unleash some shit at some points, but even when we get to that big finale, he never intends to kill anybody. I mean, certainly he throws some bows down at Officer Lan. Mm-hmm. That is, I think, a little bit of personal rage. But otherwise, he's still doing minimum damage as he had the entire film, even when he sort of beats up the chief and his officer in front of the station. But when it comes to violence in the finale, he's just making sure that the police that he's carving through cannot get back up.
Right.
So comes the breaking of bones, the smashing of faces. Again, it's just that's the most efficient way he can do it, because he can't be clocking his six the entire time. He's got to make sure these fools are put down, and he's offloading and unloading their weapons and making sure that in his wake is sort of neutralized humans or weapons that have been unloaded.
Yeah, when you take the like hyper violence and gore that we usually sort of expect in this kind of movie, when you take it out of it, it feels like it makes it more about control, and that felt like that sort of became a theme of the movie, where it's like you realize that you're not necessarily craving him murdering a bunch of people, you're just craving him like reasserting control over mm-hmm. the situation.
Yes, and that's humiliating. It's like, yeah. There's people out in this world that, I fucking hate. And
seriously,
I don't want to see them hurt.
Yeah.
What's awesome is it the French guys, when instead of doing some horrific act of violence, they get pies and they pie politicians in the face.
Yeah.
That's the fucking best, because it's dressing them down. It's owning them. And I mean, this is of course more physical, but Terry does not want, he knows how this movie will end, or his life will end, if he leaves in his wake 16 dead cops. It's just, he doesn't exist past the last frame in this movie. And I wanted it to be like, it was important for me, now that we're into full on spoiler world, 'cause it's already been out. It's I wanted my guy to cross the finish line, you know, and so did he. And the theme of the film, his first instinct is to get the fuck out of there and just and be a, he has to grapple with his own cowardice when he comes back to town, when it flares back up. But he made that pragmatic decision, and he sort of makes a choice to, as he says, you know, for tactical retrograde, surrender.
What was the inspiration? You had me from the opening credits because I'm a huge Maiden fan, but it sort of struck me as like just an interesting choice. You know, this guy, this song probably came out before this guy was born. And what are we sort of hinting at by opening the movie with that? I was just wondering if you had some sort of like grand plan for that, or you just thought it sounded kick-ass.
Yeah, it just popped into my head. It was, you know, the preface to the script is just Iron Maiden. and then it's page one. Yeah, I thought like, I just wanted to start with some majestic metal, set the tone. And then of course, do the rug pull when he gets hit by the cruiser. But I did a lot of, you know, sludgy, dreadful shit, and I like that, and I revel in it. But majestic metal has its place, and
absolutely,
there's not enough Iron Maiden in cinema. So I felt it was my obligation to right that wrong.
Be the change you want to see in the world. Exactly. And I love you for it.
Thank you.
I've seen him twice.
Nice.
I know we've had you for a while. We want to do one more, and then we'll let you go.
I had you guys sitting around for 20 minutes, so whatever. It's your time now.
We appreciate it.
That was actually a power play. I wanted to see, just to fuck with you.
Yeah.
To have you wait for 20 minutes, and then I'm like, here I am. And
yeah.
Just watching us sweat.
Because you guys outnumber me.
Always right. Order the most complicated drink. Yeah. Any meeting. So like, what were you reading about civil asset forfeiture that sort of inspired this? Or was that something that came along halfway through in the process of researching?
There was a development project way back after Blue Ruin that was intriguing. It was about the law enforcement side of it. But I was aware of civil asset forfeiture. Didn't really dig in deep. It didn't end up happening. I went and did Green Room instead. But I was also, you know, getting newsletters from the SPLC and just finding these things in articles. And I'd forgotten about everything else. It was one article about a forfeiture, a seizure of cash. You know, it was like so many different things, actually. I began to notice this trend. You know, it wasn't just one group of people being affected, and it was, you know, marginalized citizens like in the Deep South. It was poker players having $100K crossing state lines to do an all cash poker tournament, had a roach in their ashtray, stopped. The cops said that their drug dealers took it all. They had proof of where they were going. It seemed like that can't actually happen.
Yeah.
Ranchers in Texas, you know, huge property, sprawling farm, had a couple of marijuana plants on it, about a dozen. Cops came, took the plants, seized the entire property, every bit of farm equipment on it, tractors, trucks. This is millions of dollars of stuff. So it was affecting like Texas ranchers, you know, young black men in South Carolina. It was something that just affected everybody, and it pissed everybody off. I said, wow, this is a really cool way, a unifying thing that anyone will get behind.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They see this wrong committed. It's a nice, fun, quick shortcut to, you know, one of my influences, you know, as far as the deep research and these lofty sort of high art genre films that I'm aspiring to sort of emulate. It's also Better Off Dead. You know, I want my $2. That shit was so fun. To be like, it's just a guy trying to stay on the rails and just trying to get his money back, and how people would just get behind that journey. So
yeah, that was.
I just want to say that I think I commend you for it takes a lot of self-control to not read about civil asset forfeiture and make it a movie in which the lead just murders everybody. You know, I feel like you could, I would probably do that for just being on hold for too long at the doctor's office, you know? So it's, yeah. You know, like, I like that, you know, the movie was set in reality in terms of like, there's real stakes here. He can't just go around murdering people, no matter how, inconvenienced he is, or, you know, no matter how mad you are while reading about civil asset forfeiture. It also makes it so that the movie, and this is, I think, a theme with a lot of your movies, is this heavy tension, because, you know, you're not just handing death out like Tic Tacs. Like, you know, it's always in the background. It's always a possibility. Violence is always a possibility, but you don't know when or how. And I think it's one of the things that you excel at in a way that after your movies, I always feel like I need to get a massage, you know, like I get real tense.
I'll take that. Yeah, yeah, it's true. I mean, to me, I never thought that I was like going soft, because for this guy to just fuck up that many cops, you know, yeah, was a stretch. And also I wanted to make this more realistic in that he's a real person in my movie, not just, I mean, he's an action hero as far as like the context of how we're going to categorize it and expect things from him. But he's not going to win on his own. He's not going to have the smartest idea every time. It's not Jason Bourne. It's not John Wick. And he is vulnerable. And there's times in the film where he'd just be dead, shot in a ditch, if it weren't for some people. And again, it wasn't this altruistic turn, like the cops turned good. It was like, people have limits. Like, you know, hey, I'm down for the team, guys. I'll say what needs to be said, but I'm not down with murder, especially like we're all sitting here. It makes me feel bad. So when the cops sort of unite, it's not always, you know, with like, let's become good citizens.
Yeah, let's stop doing civil asset forfeiture. They're like, no, we gotta just stop this guy.
Let's protect our own. And also, Terry is the same way. He's when he saves Marston, right? He's not, it's not like, you know, they're brothers. He's like, fuck it. Not only am I trained to help this guy, he's there, he's bleeding out. It's also, I need this cop as cover.
Yeah.
He's a human shield.
Yeah, he was a human shield.
Why they don't just open up and just, you know, shoot through the vehicle. So again, like it's people have expectations, and it's funny to see the reactions. Like there's a bloodlust out there, and I can appreciate that.
Sure.
But I had to stay true to like, well, what would Terry do? Terry is, you know, when I get into my films, you know, I certainly love to show it to audiences, but I think what I can do, and I have the privilege of doing, you know, is not having a ton of notes that sort of make this like every other movie.
Right.
And when I'm writing it, it is not for me. It is for, I'm writing Terry. Like, I got to protect him. I got to think how he thinks and get him out of here. And, you know, I can't always aim to please, because that's how things become sad and pathetic.
I mean, I'm glad you brought up John Wick, because I was thinking about this too, where I realize this is probably heresy for like the internet crowd. I feel like it's such a universally beloved movie by online people, but yeah, I mean, my take on it is like, by the third set piece where he's murking 75 henchmen, I'm kind of like, all right, okay, we've seen this. And so it's not for me, but I would draw a contrast between your movie, where I think that's why I liked it so much, is it's like, you know, it's not just going to be this like bloodbath that's so over the top that by the end you're kind of inured to it and it doesn't have the same impact.
There's also the element of surprise is still there, you know, like it's still living in not knowing what's going to happen next, I guess.
Yeah. Also, you can't really watch I can't even enjoy Marvel movies, because I'm like, well, they're not going to kill anyone important, you know what I mean? Like, it's just, there's no stakes in a lot of action movies, I feel like, because either the star power is too big to, you know, I mean, you know, you can't kill Tom Cruise and Jack Reacher, right? Or, you know, it's just it's already a preconceived franchise. Whereas with this, you really don't know. And it's set in a reality in which he can't just go around killing guys. So it makes the movie surprising at every turn, which is great.
And perhaps I'm using my own filmography like to kind of add an edge to it where people think it's going to end horribly and everyone's going to die, you know?
Yeah. That's you're expecting point. Some more gore than happens for sure.
Yeah. We actually had to add some gore because I was like, guys, we did this. The elbow break was clean. It was still horrific. That was all practical, you know, these amazing apparatus that the FX team made when Terry snapped the elbow. But, you know, going through it, I'd cut some other stuff out. I was like, oof, you know, we need some bone coming out, guys. Called on the visual effects team, and I had them add the bone and the blood, and then sent that back to the practical makeup team to make sure they approved, because, you know, it's all sacred to me as far as the people who designed these effects and didn't want to just, like, you know, patch over. And, you know, my visual effects supervisor is a close friend, and just he doesn't do wacky shit, but still gotta have a sign off, because makeup is, you know, a religion for me.
Oh, absolutely.
Of course, you know, don't worry, next one will have some more gore. I'm back.
Good. More death.
Well, we loved it. I didn't think it needed more gore. I thought it was just right. I feel like I understood where you're going with that. Again, I appreciate you taking the time. I think we all love the movie. I feel like this is the first movie that is not the first movie in a while that's not only universally loved by basically everyone, but everyone's reaction is everyone that I know who saw it said, "Hey, this movie rips!" Like in yes. those exact words. Yes. That was my headline. Brendan hadn't seen that when he texted us like the same thing. It's like, yeah, everybody that I've talked to says that about it. Basically,
That's awesome.
And I came into it completely blind because I didn't know about this movie at all. And I thought everyone was talking about Hacksaw Ridge. and then I watched it. I was like, this is not Hacksaw Ridge. This is a whole other movie. So you Where's beat out Swede? Hacksaw Ridge.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
I do have one quick question before we go. I'd love to hear your take on what do you think is the best punk rock band of all time?
Punk rock? I mean, it varies, but my favorite is the Misfits.
Yeah.
Hell yeah. This is a pro Misfits podcast.
It's very pro Misfits podcast.
Okay, good.
One day we'll get Danzig on.
I haven't licensed it, so I don't know, but the film that I'm writing now, it opens with depending, either Misfits or Samhain, but you know, it's Glenn, baby.
Yeah, it's got to be Glenn. It's got to be Glenn. Sorry, Jerry only.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.